Leora is the only person in the world who knows this. There is a city underneath the city of New York. We are not talking about the subways, or the basements, or the parking garages, or the money vaults, or the underground shopping arcades, or the train stations, or the sewer systems, or the telephone cables, or the rat nests. Nor do we mean the organized crime rings, or the drug smugglers, or the sex merchants, or the undercover agents, or the palm greasing, or the deal breaking, or the star making, or the muck raking, or the illegal immigrants, or the sweatshop slaves, or the children crammed into tiny homes, or the secret interlocking passageways that run between private people's hearts. No, we are talking about a real city, a parallel city whose foundations rest on the bottom of New York Harbor. It is a city made up entirely of things that the people in the world above it have forgotten, all that they have decided, deliberately or otherwise, to cast into the ocean. Now, you probably already have an image in your mind of what this lost city might look like. You probably imagine people riding those giant front-wheeled bicycles down streets bustling with bustled women to the tune of ragtime music. Or maybe you envision trumpeting jazz bands, real-life swing dancers, or speakeasies, or white gangsters. Maybe you're thinking of robber barons wearing monocles while smoking pipes in palatial homes, or scrappy, good-natured newsboys in tweed caps shouting, "Extra, extra!" Or perhaps you've even drawn a mental picture, not yet painted by numbers, of billowing sailing ships and men in powdered wigs. But the Lost City is not a warehouse for nostalgia. It's not a showcase of the versions of the past that exist only in the present, created out of a mix of thin air and our even thinner ability to see the beauty of the current moment. No, the Lost City, and there may well be other lost cities, lurking beneath the Sen or the Yangtze, or the Crimean, or the Nile, or the Baltic, or the Ganges, or the Amazon, or the Danube, or the Amsterdam canals, but here we're speaking only of New York. The Lost City contains only things that we have truly abandoned, created exclusively out of what we believe to be lost forever. It is a walled city, this city beneath the city of New York. Its southern wall stands thick and strong, composed of the remains of the wall that once lined Wall Street, the old fortifications built long ago by the settlers of New Amsterdam, back when the greatest sign of a city's strength was what it was capable of keeping out, rather than what it was capable of letting in. As we have said, the Lost City is a walled city, but only nominally so. The city is so crowded, so overwhelmingly full, so teeming and screaming and churning and burning with all that we have now forgotten, that it spills out over its walls, the wretched refuse of its teeming shores pushing out in every direction, until the walls surrounding its inner core become little more than a technicality. In this underwater sanctuary, however, the huddled masses all breathe free. Its citizens, their bodies remembering the form of a fetus inside a saline womb, breathe through gills in their necks. The language spoken here varies from time to time. In the beginning, it was the chirping of birds, vast flocks of birds, sent down below by slash and burn farming above. Then, and this has been true for centuries, the lingua franca of this lost city became Manhattan. No, not some metaphorical imaginary language of wealth and poverty and crime and art, but the actual language Manhattan, spoken by the Manhattan tribe of natives who gave up the island a few hundred years ago for a set of beads worth approximately $24. Some residents of the lost city, the municipality's much envied elite, wear these beads around their necks. Of course, other languages are spoken here, too. A few hundred citizens speak 17th century Dutch. A dozen or so pride themselves on having mastered Esperanto. And lately, more and more people are picking up Yiddish. Outside the walls, the road to the lost city underneath New York is paved with tefillin. There's a zoo in the lost city, and all of its animals are extinct. The aviary is filled with dodo birds. There are fiberglass cliffs inhabited by saber-toothed tigers. There is a marine exhibit filled with animals Leora couldn't even name. Ancient animals, giant scaly things and tiny feathery things, and spiky things and slimy things that probably never made it out of the primordial soup. The mastodon show is particularly popular, because at certain times of day, children who come to the lost zoo are allowed to ride the woolly mammoths, grabbing at the behemoth's curly hair in their tight little fists, screaming and crying and begging their parents to take them down. And then, of course, she saw the dinosaurs, their might buried in their loins, their force hidden in the muscles of their bellies. But they didn't look much like dinosaurs that you see in pictures and movies. Instead of being covered with scales, they had skin, real skin, almost human, though without hair, soft in some places and calloused in others, pulled taut over muscles so that each thunderous step set off a ripple of flesh. And instead of camouflaging themselves in dulled, earthy colors, these dinosaurs were radiant. Their skin shone in iridescent blue, fading to indigo, fading to purple, fading to a deep, glowing, unearthly red, the different colors shimmering in turn depending on the motion of the water around them, like tropical fish. Still searching for novelty, though admittedly, the Lost City is not a very good place to find it. Leora wandered even further into the congested streets until a few helpful citizens directed her to the municipal library, one of the largest buildings in the Lost City. She walked up its giant barnacle-covered front stairs, feeling more certain with each slippery step that behind the seaweed-encrusted door she would at last find her buried treasures. But to her surprise, although she shouldn't have been surprised, she discovered that most of the works in the Lost City, Lost City's library, all, of course, were out of print, were the literary equivalent of trash. Romance novels, yesterday's political thrillers, Cold War espionage tales, pop biographies of people she had never heard of. The how-to section was immense, as was the self-help section. Decades worth of diet books suggesting that people starve themselves to death, cookbooks whose recipes often called for lard, child-raising books recommending that children not be spared the rod, and books promising people new ways to get rich quick, predicting market peaks and crashes that never materialized. And, of course, there were thousands of books and pamphlets filled with nothing but outmoded pornography, disappointing drawings of things no longer even considered burlesque. And then there was the trash that didn't even look familiar. Dime novels, serialized westerns, almanacs, astrological guides, crop counts carved into pieces of bark. But that was only the shelved material. Most of the library, Leora discovered, was taken up by archives. Not records of famous people, but of ordinary people. The sort of people whose loose letters and photographs would never have been immortalized in the city above, even by their grandchildren. There were endless piles of love letters, packed by the bundle. Letters whose ardor waxed hotter and hotter in each series of correspondence, and then inevitably cooled and froze into a bitter final exchange. The sort of letters, Leora thought to herself, that people throw away or burn after receiving the last one. There were application letters for jobs by the thousands, stacked by sender. There were letters from parents to children in summer camps, filled with unheeded advice about poison ivy. And letters from parents to children in military camps, returned to sender, unopened. And then there were the photographs, color, black and white, sepia, all the way back to lithographs, in piles miles high, unlabeled, loose photographs of who knew who, taken who knew where, who knew when, fallen from photo albums, out of context and out of time. It occurred to Leora, as she flipped through these photographs of people who were beginning to look increasingly familiar, that all her wandering in the Lost City thus far had been somewhat beside the point. Dropping the photographs she was holding, and abandoning the stacks of literary trash behind her, she exited the barnacled doors and headed for the Lost City Hall to consult the local registers and find out whether she might actually know any of the residents of the Lost City. Yes, the registers. There are no phone directories in the Lost City because telephones have not yet made it here, though telegrams are popular. As Leora walked, or rather swam, or more precisely, drifted to the Lost City Hall, she realized that she might once more be setting herself up for disappointment. After all, she had gone to the library with high hopes and had uncovered almost nothing. It seemed absurd to expect anything more from City Hall. But in the Lost City, one quickly finds that it is impossible to dismiss absurd thoughts, or any thoughts at all for that matter. There's nowhere left to dismiss them to. The clerk at the Lost City Hall seemed vaguely familiar. He was a stringy sort of man, young, with a mop of brown hair and a series of pimples on one side of his mouth. "Are you looking for someone in particular?" he asked Leora. He brought out a pile of giant ledger books, patting the one on top with his hand after he had set them down. "You realize," he said, "we've got hundreds of these back here. They only cover errors of written language, though. If you're looking for someone from before then, just ask me and I'll see what I can do. No, this is fine, she answered quickly, taking the top four books in the stack. Leora sat down and slowly opened the first alphabetical volume. The pages were gigantic, folio-sized, like an old religious book. Of course, the entries were all written by hand. She looked up her own name first, breathing a sigh of relief when she saw that she wasn't listed. Then she began flipping pages to hunt down her friend Naomi, who had died as a teenager. But on the way to Naomi, on a whim, she looked up her old boyfriend Jason. To her surprise, he was there. And to her absolute shock, so was she, listed right beside him, Mr. and Mrs. She slammed the book shut. Find what you're looking for, the clerk called from behind the desk. Shrinking back in her seat, Leora stared at the book in front of her as if it were growing uncontrollably, the folio widening and thickening, until she could imagine all the listings within it. The boyfriend she hadn't married, the jobs she hadn't taken, the acquaintances she had abandoned, the endless roster of people she hadn't become. And then, beyond that, stood the listings of all the people everyone else hadn't become, all the endless numbers of people who could have been but weren't. She felt her hand being drawn back toward the book's cover, her fingers edging up over the waterlogged table toward the outdated green leather binding. But then she slammed her hands down and stood up from her seat. Yes, thank you for your help, she called to the clerk, her voice self-consciously loud. And she ran out of the room before he had a chance to respond.